Support for Radio Boston comes from Hadestown at the Box Center Wang Theater, Broadway's Tony and Grammy-winning Best Musical, an epic celebration of music, togetherness, and hope, raves Forbes. Playing April 23rd through April 28th. Buy your tickets today at boxcenter.org.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. In the news this week, a parent's nightmare. An infant forgotten in a daycare van in Dorchester died, leaving family members, neighbors, and state officials demanding answers.
A youngest citizen was lost. A family is without their son. And we're going to look at every policy, every procedure to make sure there's nothing more we can do.
Also this week, another Democrat says she wants to challenge Republican Senator Scott Brown.
I'm Elizabeth Warren, and I'm running for the United States Senate.
And a bill that would bring gambling to the state blows through the House of Representatives.
The citizens of this Commonwealth, by large numbers, support expanded gaming.
So that's a quick rundown of this week's top stories. And joining us now for our regular Friday Week in Review is Peter Kanellis, editorial page editor at the Boston Globe. Hey, Peter.
Hi.
And Kyle Chaney, reporter with the State House News Service. Kyle, good to have you.
Good to be back.
So let's start with the big political story. Elizabeth Warren, the Harvard Law School professor and consumer advocate who helped set up the new Consumer Protection Agency in Washington, she made it official this week. She joined six other Democrats who hope to unseat Senator Scott Brown. And she posted her announcement online saying that middle-class Americans are under assault, Washington doesn't get it, and large corporations have all the advantages.
A big company like GE pays nothing in taxes, and we're asking college students to take on even more debt to get an education. We're telling seniors they may have to learn to live on less. It isn't right, and it's the reason I'm running for the United States Senate.
So, gentlemen, do you think this is a message that will resonate with voters, especially in these economic hard times? Peter Kanellis, let me start with you.
I think that it will resonate with voters in this these times. And I think the fact that she has a very clear message is going to be an asset. That doesn't mean that I think it's a slam dunk for her getting the nomination. I think a lot of people in Washington and even some in Massachusetts, you know, feel like it's sort of a foreordained conclusion that she will get the nomination. I think it's going to be a tough primary race. But I do think that there's room for a candidate who takes the economic issues in a class-based way and takes the fight to the corporations.
Peter, I'm glad you mentioned the other candidates and the primary race, because of course there are six other candidates: Alan Kazee, political activist Bob Massey, Newton Mayor Seti Warren, Wayland State Rep Tom Conroy, Herb Robinson, and lawyer Marisa DeFranco. But Kyle, let me come to you. Let's assume that she does get the nomination. What kind of race are we going to look at?
I think you're already seeing sort of the Republican playbook to respond to her candidacy. They refer to her fairly derisively as Professor Warren, and they're going to try to portray her as an out of touch creature of Washington. And so I think you're already seeing that line start to develop. They almost, in a sense, are treating it as though she is the nominee. And I think she's going to push back and say that Scott Brown is look where the Wall Street money is going. He's not the candidate of the middle class.
Now, it's interesting that you brought that up. We've got a piece of tape to play. This is in regard to what Republicans are labeling her. Even her friend and Harvard Law colleague Lawrence Tribe picked up on this. This is what he told WBUR earlier this week.
A weakness, and I hate to say this as a Harvard professor, is that she's a Harvard professor. That's not the first thing that many people in Massachusetts want to see. They will need to be persuaded that she is not part of any ivory tower.
And others are pointing out she's not originally from Massachusetts, so a carpetbagger to boot. Will those charges stick, Peter Kanellis?
I think it's hard to tell right now. I think that the fact that she has such a populist message and that she identifies so strongly with working class and middle class people, you know, partly inoculates her from that charge. You know, this isn't somebody who's a liberal pushing an economic scheme or talking about, you know, investments and competitiveness and things like that. This is somebody who's talking bread and butter issues for middle class families. And I think it's much harder to portray somebody like that as being elitist and out of touch. I do think that not being from Massachusetts has some disadvantages. I remember back to the governor's race between Scott Harshbarger and Paul Cellucci. I always felt like Paul Cellucci kind of put the Boston accent or the Massachusetts accent, you know, into battle against Scott Harshbarger. And, you know, Harshbarger's from Pennsylvania, and it just didn't look and feel quite right here in Massachusetts. So some of that may come out. She doesn't feel like one of us. But I think she's pretty well protected against the elitism charge.
Sure. But Kyle, assuming she does end up facing Scott Brown, it would be a fascinating race to cover and watch. I mean, it's such a study in contrasts. I mean, an in-stater, an out-of-stater, mm-hmm. a fiery, outspoken consumer activist, a liberal Harvard professor versus this plain-spoken, conservative, relatively quiet, but politically effective, Scott Brown.
Sure, and keying off of what Peter said, you know, I think that there's been little evidence, I think, in recent years that Massachusetts voters particularly prejudice someone who goes to Harvard or is from Harvard. You know, I mean, Governor Patrick himself is, you know, Harvard grad and made no secret of that. But it would be an interesting race. I think Scott Brown will always capture people's fascination given his sort of meteoric rise to where he got to be. And it's really a test of is he an enduring type of political candidate, or was it just a phenomenon that propelled him to where he is?
Fascinating. Well, let's move on to the issue of casino gambling, which took a step closer to establishing a beachhead here in Massachusetts. On Beacon Hill, the House overwhelmingly passed a bill this week to authorize 3 resort casinos, 1 slots parlor. Among the supporters was Joe Wagner, a Democratic rep from Chicopee.
It's an opportunity for us as a Commonwealth to bring online a sector of industry that doesn't exist at present here in Massachusetts, and that would add the jobs and revenues that are so sorely needed for this Commonwealth now and going forward.
Now, among the very few opposed to the bill, Newton Representative Ruth Balzer, who spoke against the bill.
Some say it's a form of entertainment, a legitimate business to grow our economy. I reject that. It is a predatory business, exploiting the hopes and dreams of vulnerable people, profiting from developing addiction and debt.
So, gentlemen, your reaction? Is this good for Massachusetts, good for jobs, or do we risk becoming the Commonwealth of addiction, debt, and moral decay? Peter Canellos.
I think there's that risk. I mean, I would say that the main argument against it is not primarily the addiction argument, because there are other ways that people who are prone to gambling can gamble. It's more the question of whether our political system is able to handle all of the temptations that come with gambling. Mm. And I remember I was out by the State House after this vote, and the members were coming out. They were like, you know, children with a sugar high. They had that sort of hyped up feeling like something big had happened. And you realize that in their world, with all these different proposals and all these big money people floating around and all that, it feels like this is just a big, big moment. I don't think it's going to deliver all that much for the average person. And I worry that, you know, with all the moving parts in this bill, there's so many opportunities for members of the legislature to put a sort of thumb on the scale for one group or another group, or to one interest or another interest, and the campaign contributions coming in. I think it is a recipe for corruption.
Mm. What do you think, Kyle? And let me ask you first. I mean, I'd love to get your overall reaction to it, but you're up there at the State House. Is this, my understanding is that this bill is going to pass pretty easily through the Senate. Is that correct? Is that your take?
It's looking likely. I mean, the votes were there last year, and things haven't changed all too much. There's a crop of freshmen that still have yet to be tested on it, although for the most part, I think people seem pretty confident this is going to happen. It's pretty much a done deal. The Senate actually released a bill just a couple hours ago that almost mirrored identically the House's bill, with a couple tweaks here and there, but nothing substantive. So looking like this is destined for the governor's desk.
Mm. Well, I sort of see both sides of this argument. I mean, Peter raised some concerns there. To me, though, it seems like there was a time when it seemed to make sense to keep casinos out, keep them limited to Las Vegas and Atlantic City. But now the gambling genie has been out of the bottle for so long. There are slots in Rhode Island, casinos in Connecticut, more coming to the region. What of the argument that we might as well keep this gambling revenue in the state? Kyle.
Well, I think that that's sort of one of the more compelling arguments put forward by the proponents who say, you know, you talk all you want about the social ills. People are going to Connecticut gambling, bringing those social ills back to Massachusetts, and we're not getting any cut of the economic benefit. Mm. And so that probably is among the chief arguments for it. The question is then, do you engage in an arms race with other states who are competing to take that cut back or split it up in so many different ways? And you know, the other economic question is what gambling facilities do to surrounding businesses and communities? Do they actually create jobs or do they cannibalize other businesses? So, you know, I think it can cut both ways there.
Well, we'll have to see where it goes. Interesting story to follow. Let's turn now to this incredibly disturbing story about the death of a baby that was left unattended in a daycare van. 17-month-old Gabriel Josh Kazir Pierre of Dorchester died this week when the driver of the daycare van he was in apparently forgot he was there and left him. Now, this story raises big questions about daycare safety and about transportation standards. The state does require vans like the one in which this child died and its drivers to be registered and to follow certain procedures. Here's Early Education and Care Commissioner Sherry Killens.
That plan requires that attendance is taken when children get on the bus and that attendance is taken when children get off of the transportation. And finally, when the end of the route comes, the driver is supposed to go inside of the transportation and make sure that all the children are removed. So clearly something failed.
Something failed indeed. And this tragedy has prompted a review of state and city laws meant to protect children. Peter Canellos, does this accident look to you like just one tragic aberration? Or does it point to a need for broader safety standards? What's your take?
I think it does point to the need for broader safety standards. Mm. There's no real enforcement mechanism for those rules that the commissioner was describing, and there's some sense you can sort of envision how this goes through, that people come in and they'll probably, you know, fill out some paperwork and take a test and sign up, and that's it. And there has to be more rigor in the system if the state is going to pay for this. I think if the state is stepping forward to offer daycare vouchers and transportation, it is incumbent on the state to make sure that it's safe.
One of the details that I was sort of surprised to hear is that daycare centers have to notify parents after the third absence. I gather there are calls now that daycare centers should notify parents each and every time a child fails to show up. Kyle, what's your take on what needs to happen here, or how state lawmakers are going to respond?
Well, you know, they interestingly enough, actually, in the gambling bill that passed the House on Wednesday, they added a provision to require people to check cars and parking lots for abandoned children.
That's part of the
gambling bill. It's actually been raised in prior years, so it's not totally related to current events. But it happened that the timing couldn't have been more coincidental. The governor said yesterday at a morning event that he has ordered, obviously, a review of all policies, regarding transportation of children. But he said, you know, The other thing to keep in mind is it might be hard to legislate or issue policies regarding something as commonsensical as looking in the back seat of a car or a van. And so he seemed sort of split about what the state can really do.
Hmm. It does raise that question. Peter, what can the state really do?
I think that having a more robust procedure for complaining about people and enforcing some of the standards that are in licenses. This doesn't mean you have to have an army of people. This is an enormous benefit, but a couple of enforcement officers and a place where people can call if they feel as though a driver has been irresponsible in any way. That's the kind of thing we should be looking at.
Mm. Okay, everyone. Time now for our weekly hubbub. We want to focus on those small items that didn't quite make it above the fold this week. Kyle Chaney, let me start with you. What's your hubbub this week?
Well, Governor Patrick was put in a bit of an awkward spot yesterday by a colleague, the governor of Colorado, who was in town during a meeting with some business leaders at the Intercontinental Hotel in Boston. Governor Hickenlooper of Colorado asked Governor Patrick about his post-public life future when Patrick finishes his second term. He also called him a likely presidential candidate, which I think the governor sort of laughed off. But Patrick opened up and said he's looking at potentially running a company someday, helping companies build their brands. And, it was more detailed than he's provided on that topic before.
Interesting. Magna, love to hear your hubbub.
Hi, gentlemen. My hubbub has a totally different tone. It starts with, let me just start with this piece of tape.
Hello, I'm Margaret Jo McCullen.
And I'm Terry Rialto. And you're listening to The Delicious Dish on National Public Radio.
Okay, so before anyone gets confused, that's actually not an NPR show.
Oh, that's from, I'm so relieved.
That's from a Saturday Night Live skit, a classic one featuring Alec Baldwin.
Please welcome the owner of Seasons Eatings, Pete Schwede.
Well, Pete, Terry and I have been looking forward to having you on the show because we know you're the master of all kinds of Christmas goodies. Tell us about them.
Well, there are lots of great treats at this time of year. Zucchini bread, fruitcake. But the thing that I most like to bring out at this time of the year are my balls.
Okay, so we figured it made it past NBC's censor, so it might be okay for our broadcast. But the reason why I bring it up is, yes, we are public radio, and I hope Radio Boston doesn't necessarily sound like that. But this is a wonderful marriage between late-night comedy, public radio, and a New England ice cream icon, because Ben and Jerry's just recently released a Schwede Balls flavored ice cream.
That's what it's called, Schwede Balls.
It's called Schwede Balls in honor of Pete Schwede, a.k.a. Alec Baldwin. That is a fair trade vanilla ice cream with a hint of rum and is loaded with fudge-covered rum and milk chocolate malt balls. Okay. Sure to fly off the freezer shelves at your local grocer's.
Peter Canellos, Megna has set a high bar.
Or a very low bar,
for this week's hubbub, which you are now going to have to surmount or pass under.
Well, I have a question. Do Massachusetts business people feel like they'll be more likely to relocate in New Hampshire if they go to Hampton Beach and hear the aging punk band B-52s, no disrespect to them, play in an old ballroom on Hampton Beach? This is the latest effort by New Hampshire economic development officials to take Massachusetts businesses across the border. And it strikes me, the whole enterprise strikes me as being sort of like siblings trying to steal each other's clothes. Like, it's very counterproductive. We should be working together in this region to try to develop industries and attract businesses from other countries and other places to make the pie bigger rather than try to steal pieces of the pie for each state.
Right. So here's my hubbub. It's not exactly below the fold, but it's about the Red Sox. Okay, so what's going on here? They're fading. Tampa Bay is catching up with them. It looks like they're doing one of these classic late season chokes for which they used to be famous. But here's the thing, and this sort of gets to the heart of my hubbub. I don't really care. And it's incredibly liberating to say that. I'm a lifelong Red Sox fan. I used to live and die with them. I used to sort of anguish when this sort of stuff had happened. But now that they've won a couple of World Series, I can just sort of, say, oh, well, they're fading.
And
it's sort of. However, there's another part of the story that I really can't not think of. Boston, $161 million payroll. Tampa Bay, $41 million. And Tampa Bay is eating their lunch. In fact, with Tampa Bay's payroll, I was just looking at these numbers before I got on the air, you could buy John Lackey, Carl Crawford, and J.D. Drew. Those three players amount to more than $41 million, the entire Tampa Bay payroll. So I found that interesting.
They should move to New Hampshire.
Great suggestion. Peter Canellos, editorial page editor of the Boston Globe, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Anthony.
And Kyle Chaney, reporter, State House News Service, thank you.
And thank you as well.
And have a great weekend to both of you.
Well, up next, here's a sound that might make your skin crawl. When your partner's true partner is a cell phone. Love in the age of wireless. That's after the break. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.